The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Hey, everyone, we're going to get started. It's just past noon. Thank you for coming. I'm Robin Fulton. I'm with the Office of Career and Professional Development. And on behalf of the office, I'm pleased to be here to launch the first in a series of programs today addressing issues, strategies, and techniques for getting hired by and ultimately working for small and mid-sized legal employers. Before we get started, you should all have a handout of Donna's presentation. If you don't, it's okay. It's available electronically on the OCPD website and the document library. And the program is also being podcast, so if you know of someone who wanted to make it but couldn't because of schedule conflicts, please let that person know that they can access it on the podcast page of the WCL website. So we're beginning today's programming with Choosing Small, Choosing Smart, Job Search Strategies for Law Students, presented by our guest speaker, Ms. Donna Gerson. OCPD will also present a panel of small and mid-sized legal employers beginning at 4:30 p.m. here in room 603. The panel will reveal what life is like in a small firm, how these employers hire, what they're looking for, and who ends up being a successful associate in these environments. And immediately following that panel will be a networking reception where students can mingle with the panelists, ask more focused questions, and put into practice some of the networking tips that Donna will soon be sharing with us. Donna Gerson is a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania and Temple University Beasley School of Law, and she holds a Master's of Library and Information Science from the University of Pittsburgh. After clerking for a judge in Philadelphia, Donna worked briefly as a litigator in Pittsburgh before joining the Career Services Office at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. She served as the director there for 7 years until 2001. She's now a contributing editor for Student Lawyer Magazine, an American Bar Association publication, and is currently at work on a 3-book career advice series for West Publishing. She has also published books which are available in our office, including Choosing Small, Choosing Smart, and Building Career Connections. We're very excited to have Donna with us today. She spent many years counseling law students, working with legal employers, visiting law schools across the nation, and she definitely understands the demands facing you as law students, as well as current hiring practices. Please join me in welcoming to the Washington College of Law, Ms. Donna Gerson.
Hi, welcome, and you have a wonderful day planned for all of you. I hope you go to the panel discussion and definitely go to the networking program afterwards. I'm going to, let me see, because this looks blank here. Robin, my screen is blank.
That would be an issue.
But I can do this. Anyway, I don't know why that is. It's going to help me to do this right. So I just wanted to say that I'm going to speak for about 1 hour. And I'm going to try to have time for questions and answers. I write for the American Bar Association, and so I'm always very interested to hear what law students have to say and what's on your mind. Okay, that'll help. But I'm going to keep talking because your time is valuable and you want to get through this and go to your classes. I'm going to talk to you today about small firm hiring, not just small law firms, but also government agencies, NGOs, and other entities that might be in the area. What really motivated me to start writing about small law firms, and this was really the start of my writing work, was the fact that when I was working as the director of placement at the University of Pittsburgh, you go through this hysteria with on-campus interviewing. I don't know if any of you have noticed this, where it seems like the entire world is going on-campus interviews and there's nothing else going on. But the reality was when I did some research, I found out that the American Bar Foundation did a wonderful study of all the lawyers in the United States. And what I discovered was that about 73% of all lawyers, you just have to touch it?
That was hope.
Okay. Thank you. 73% of all lawyers work in private practice. So when you look at a pie chart of the profession, 3/4 of all the lawyers you're going to meet in practice are going to be in private sector, and the rest are going to be in government agencies and nonprofit and public interest, in-house counsel and the like. But of those lawyers in private practice, 66% are at firms of 50 or fewer lawyers, which is an amazing number when you think about it, because you get this feeling when you're in law school, both on the law student side, which I've been on the law student side, and on the career counseling side, that everyone's at a big law firm, and if you're not at a big law firm, your life is a total and utter waste, and everything else is second best, and this is a terrible thing, so what are you going to do? But as I started, that was really the impetus for my first book, and I can always talk to you about non-traditional careers in writing as well, but I found that when you write about something that is near and dear to your heart, and also that hasn't been discussed before, you can really have an audience, and it gives you a lot of, it's nice to have that influence to be able to speak about this. So I interview, what I do all day long most of the time is either interview law students, so when I'm here at the law school, I've met with some law students today, and I talk to lawyers all day long. So what I talk to you about here today isn't sort of, you know, my, like, imagining about this, but I talk to lawyers about this constantly. So what we're going to learn today is why you might want to work at a small firm or an agency or a nonprofit, how to narrow down this tremendous universe. Oops. How to conduct research. The importance of networking. Now, I can do an entire program on networking, and I'm going to give you about 7 minutes of what you might want to do this evening with your panel discussion folks. How to do an individual database of who you want to write to, whether you're a first year, second year, or graduating third year. How to contact those employers, follow-up strategies, and interview tips, all in the next 45 minutes. But I'm going to start with this interesting statistic, and this is also from that American Bar Foundation study that I was referring to earlier, and it just gives you an idea about what's going on in Washington, D.C. And Washington, D.C. is unusual, because you'll notice at the very bottom there, federal government employer employment is 41% of all the lawyers in D.C., which is really, really skewed off base, obviously, because this is Washington, D.C. But Washington, D.C. also has the distinction of being the place where there are the most lawyers per civilian population, to put it any other way. So this place is just lousy with lawyers. What is a small firm? Generally speaking, a small firm is a firm of 50 or fewer attorneys. You'll see a lot of different studies, though, whether it's the National Law Journal or the National Association for Law Placement. And just look really carefully, because they'll usually define at the bottom of the study or bar graph a small firm is. 50 or fewer is the biggest number for small firm. You know, you'll sometimes see 25 or fewer. Second bullet point is important, too. That the definition of small firm is going to vary from region to region in the country. So, for instance, if you're looking at a smaller market, like a Pittsburgh or a Columbus, Ohio, or the like, 50 might be a big firm or a mid-sized firm in those places, whereas if you go to New York and ask a lawyer who's at a Manhattan firm, you know, they'll say, I work at a firm of 100 lawyers, it's a small firm. Well, relative to what else is in Manhattan, small is relative, and that they believe that, although 100 lawyers in Pittsburgh would be a very large firm. Branch offices of big firms are not by definition small firms. Sometimes you'll see like Morgan, Lewis & Bockius has 33 or so lawyers in Pittsburgh. This is where I'm from. And students will say 33 lawyers, that's a small firm. Well, become sophisticated about the names of those big, big firms, which it's not hard to do in this environment, because when you see that it's a branch office of a big firm, you're really dealing with a big firm. They hire like a big firm. They look at the criteria that big firms look at, and so just be sophisticated about that. Why would you want to work in a small venue? I'm going to give you a distillation of three reasons that employers and students have said to me over the years. The first one is, in a smaller environment, you're more likely to get more responsibility earlier in your career, meaning there's less management between you and the client. You don't have, you know, a senior associate and a senior partner and a junior partner and a paralegal and a secretary. It might be you and the client very early in your career. You might be going to depositions. You might be counseling clients soon after you get your license to practice law. So you want to be comfortable or excited about the idea that you're going to have responsibility early in your career. You're going to use your entrepreneurial skills to build a business, because this is information that you really want to work into your interviews and cover letters to distinguish yourselves. people who work at small firms, you can really add value to the business by bringing in business and really thinking about law as a business where you're going to bring in clients. This will be music to the ears of many small firm employers who are tired of hearing I, or what are you going to do for me. If you talk about law as a business, they'll sit up and listen and say, here's someone who understands what I go through on a day-to-day basis. You'll also have a much shorter promotion and compensation trajectory, meaning you might start at a very low level, and I'll show you what the salary information is like based on the latest NALF study. This is a national study from across the country. When you speak to small firm employers about starting salaries, you're never going to get a number, and it's very regionally based, and you have to talk to your career services office. So this is just giving you some guidance about what's out there nationally. It could be quite a bit lower in other parts, in some parts of the country, and it could be somewhat higher in larger metropolitan areas. But small firm employers have said, you know, we don't promote people on a lockstep basis. For example, at large law firms, you tend to make partner, if you make it through this process, in 10 to 12 years. That's what the number is right now, and that's a long time. And there's a great deal of attrition. Whereas small firm employers have generally said, you know, we only hire once every couple of years, and if the person that we hire is being useful and does good work and brings in business, I might make them an equity partner, an ownership interest in the firm in 5 years. Depending on the type of practice at a small firm, I might start them quite low, but if it's a personal injury firm and we have a very successful case and the associate contributed to the case, they will get a share of the winnings in this case. So it's all over the board about where salaries are, but you as law students should be aware that you might start out quite a bit lower and then move ahead if you're business-minded and really want to stick to it. One of the things that law students ask me as well, and I want to address this, is they'll say, well, if I'm not going to be paid a lot of money, then what can I do about flexible work hours, family-friendly, and other types of things? And I guess the other bad news to deliver is small firms have said, basically, you earn the privilege of flex time. You earn the privilege of family-friendly hours. And that these are not necessarily, by getting a lower salary than a larger firm counterpart, does not entitle anyone to have, you know, sort of special hours or you know, special perks. But you should choose a small firm for the reasons I mentioned, that you're going to get responsibility, that you're going to be promoted, that this is a business environment, and you can do very, very well practicing in this area, as the majority of private practitioners in the United States do. What do small firm employers look for? A lot of law students ask about this, and I wanted to go over sort of in rank order what comes up all the time when you talk to small firm employers. The first thing they say above anything else is, we want a student who has experience, okay? So whether if you're a first-year student just starting out or you're graduating, there is time throughout law school that you should be taking advantage of getting experience that you can put on your resume. And you don't have to worry too much about does it fit exactly. Students get very worried, like, I worked in public interest, but now I want to go into private practice. How do I transfer these skills? Don't worry. Everything can be transferred. Everything can be talked around because everything that you do as a lawyer can really be moved around. They don't care whether it's paid or unpaid. No employer has ever said, you know, I put more weight on those paid jobs than others. A lot of times the really great jobs that you might get as a first summer are going to be unpaid externships for academic credit, and they're excellent experiences, and you might be licking envelopes at a small firm somewhere and not getting great experience but getting paid, you know, some hourly wage to do that. So keep in mind that you should find things that interest you and build your resume now. That's the most important thing in the world because that's what's going to help sell you. In smaller legal markets, the second bullet point comes into play, which is a desire to work in a particular city or town. There's a lot of regionalism still in the United States. Now, in Washington, D.C., this went off again, you do not have to, explain yourself, why you're in a market. You don't have to do that in New York. You don't have to do that in Manhattan. San Francisco, Chicago, no. But if you're looking in smaller markets like Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Cleveland, Ohio, and any of those places where people might say, what brings you here? Why are you here? You have to be prepared to talk about that because that's a bona fide issue, and we're going to talk about that later. Notice the third bullet point says intelligence and not grades. Students get very, very overwrought about the grades issue, and we're going to discuss that later as well. But employers are interested to know that you're an intelligent person, and we're going to go through that. So don't worry too much about grades because they're not focused on that. And finally, if you're a third-year law student and graduating, these small firms really want to know that you're going to pass the bar because that is an important moment in your life as a lawyer, and it goes to your hireability. If you're a third-year law student looking at good graduation, don't be surprised and don't be shocked if you graduate and you don't have a job the day of graduation. That is a normal thing statistically across the United States. I know third-year students don't want to hear this, but it might alleviate some of the panic if you realize that what you have to do is graduate with the best grades possible, take the bar exam, pass the bar exam, and then you get into play with these smaller law firms. So when do employers hire? This is the thing that drives law students insane. They hire when the need arises. You're not going to find these guys coming on campus. You probably won't find these employers necessarily posting jobs even. They are totally okay with unsolicited cover letters and resumes. Law students get very caught up in this idea, and I understand this, that, you know, OCI conditions you to this idea that there's a job opening, you apply for it, you get accepted for an interview, and then magic happens, and it's a very, very passive job search process. And students get very upset at the notion of, I don't want to look like an idiot sending a cover letter and a resume for a job that doesn't exist. I'm going to wait for the job opening to occur. The fact of the matter is that small firm employers say over and over again, we don't mind getting unsolicited cover letters and resumes. We expect it. It's a way that we find employees aside from networking, and you're not the object of mockery or derision. People don't walk around the firm going, can you believe this? The student wants a job. That's so dumb. They expect this. So now it begs the question, how do you go about doing this? And I'm going to go through and talk about how we narrow this down, because one of the things that's really tough is OCI conditions you to the idea that there's a directory of large firms and it's all laid out for you. It's like a big telephone book and it's so convenient and easy. And the problem with the small firm market is it's an extremely gray market. It's sort of underground. It's very relationship-based, and you have to go out and find it. So how do you do this? First of all, you need to narrow your job search and narrow your location down to no more than three locations. Now, if you have to stay in one location, like you're going to go home to Kansas City or you're going to do something that's very, very specific, that's great. You don't have to pick three, but at least know that you're going to limit yourself to three because doing these mass mailings, these 50-state searches, are insane. And you probably all know this and you've heard this, but I'll say it again. Not only are they expensive and time-consuming, killing many trees and costing you a lot in postage, you can't possibly do a good job of it. And law firm employers can sense those mass mailings. They can pick them up. You can tell by the quality of the cover letter and the way it's written that this was just something that somebody said, I'm going to spray bullets against the wall and see what hits. It makes students feel very productive, I think, because you feel very industrious sending out 500 letters, but it doesn't do you a lot of good. So limit yourself to no more than three locations. And why does location matter? It isn't just like, oh, location is important. It goes to two things that are going to make you convincing in an interview and in a cover letter. The first is your client-getting ability. If you're living in a place because you have a logical connection there, you grew up there, you went to college there, you simply like the weather. I mean, it doesn't have to be this. You don't have to cook up a story, but if you can explain your presence in a market other than the large national metropolitan markets, you're doing yourself a favor because you're talking business with these guys. was. And you can talk about how you want to build a business, how because you have connections to this area and you want to stay here, this is very important to you. And it also goes to retention, meaning how long you're going to stay there. And there are tons of studies about law students and associates and how long they stay at particular firms. And I'll tell you this. The latest study from the National Association for Law Placement, it was called Keeping the Keepers 2. There was Keeping the Keepers 1, I guess. And it said that of all the graduates of law schools nationally, they did a study of everyone who graduated. They found that after 2 years, about 25% of those people who started at a particular firm had already left. And after 5 years, more than 50% of the students who had the associates who had started at firms all across the country had left. And this is a big issue for law firms because I recently heard the statistic that at a large law firm, before the day you start work full-time as an associate, they have assumed that they have spent close to $100,000 to recruit you. That means your salary as a summer associate, lawyer time spent interviewing you, the entertainment that goes into it, the training, if they fly you to a deposition in, you know, in Chicago for the summer and the like, that before you walk, the bar study course, the presents that they send you, all that stuff, by the time you walk in the door, they have spent $100,000 recruiting you. And so they're very, very sad to see you go after 24 months because they've lost money. They'll break even at 5 years. They want you to stay 7 years, basically, and then go away. So think about location strategically because you don't just want to pop up in a market and go, ta-da, here I am. You want to have a rational reason because, you know, you don't want to apply for a job in Anchorage, Alaska doing, you know, pet law or, you know, like you'll see stuff on Simplicity, right, and you'll go, yeah, maybe I'll do that. And you'll never be happy doing it. The employer seeing you appear in this market is going to say, why do they want to be here? So think about that when you write your cover letters, when you write your resumes, when you go for interviews. The other way to break things down and narrow this incredible world, because it's a huge, you know, it's daunting to look at, is to do it by practice areas. Now, there's no reason why law students have to specialize in law school, and I'm not telling you to specialize, but think about it this way. Employers, especially small law firms, private practice firms, kind of fall into two camps. There are either these boutique law firms that specialize in a particular practice area, and you'll see that in things like family law, criminal defense law, tax law, immigration law. You know, things group together. You don't see people who do tax and family law or immigration and, you know, they sometimes fall into very specific practice areas or themes. So there are boutique firms that specialize in those areas. And the rest of the small law firms kind of fall into the general practice camp of we're litigation driven. We do trusts and estates and we'll do some, personal injury litigation and we'll do some zoning law and the like. But if you can come forward and you say to yourself, you know what, my passion is to do healthcare law. This is what I really want to do. You can start to narrow down your focus. And we're going to talk about how you can take a market and segment it a little bit so that you're not just looking at a bar association directory going, these are all the lawyers in Philadelphia. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this. So how do you go about doing the research? What resources are available to you? The first one is, and this is probably the easiest one, is there are some markets, unbelievably, that do have the directories of small law firms. And I'll read off a list to you now, because if you're here in Washington, but if you're looking in other parts of the country, there could be a ready-made list for you, and then you can get up and leave this talk and go on your merry way. But here they are. The Chicago Consortium of Law Schools in that area, they have a 4 or more database for Chicago and the surrounding suburbs. So if you're looking in Chicago, what you have to do is go to your career services office and ask for a letter of reciprocity. You don't do it yourself. You do it through the office. You know to do this. And you can go and visit their career services offices in Chicago, pick a law school. You can sometimes access remotely with a password and get access to this information. That couldn't be easier. The University of Colorado has a listing of small and mid-sized firms in the Denver area that you can have access to with a password. The University of Wisconsin at Madison has a list of Madison, Chicago, and Milwaukee firms. So if you're looking in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, you're done. The University of Texas at Austin has a list. The University of Pittsburgh has a list. North Carolina has a list through eAttorney. This is very irritating. The University of Oregon also has a list as well. So keep that in mind because that makes life easy. There's also, interestingly, a public interest directory of private law firms that's in your career services office, and that's available at this website. It's updated. This is a collaborative effort between Harvard University and Columbia Law School. And what's interesting is there are small law firms across the United States that say we do public interest law, meaning they do First Amendment, environmental, tobacco litigation, and the like. And they're listed by city and state. So if you're interested in a small firm and you have and you're interested in a public interest environment, this is a private option that you might want to look at that could be very helpful to you. Bar association directories can be very helpful as well, and I'm going to explain why, not just because they're listings of lawyers, but what I do when I get a bar association directory, which is an A to Z list of lawyers, I like to look at the back section that has the way bar associations are typically organized is by sections, committees, and divisions, so by practice area, essentially. Now, if you're interested in family law, Bar Association Directory can be very helpful because you just go to the family law section, and you're going to get a straight listing of the names of lawyers who say they do family law, and you can cross-reference that pretty easily and figure out who's out there. You can tick off the names of the people who are at the large law firms because you'll recognize the names, but everything else that's left is a clear list of people who do that kind of practice area, which might be helpful to you. I wanted to give you a list of also, these are federal agency jobs. These are smaller federal agencies, and this is through the NALP website. That can be helpful to you. Now, there are really huge, you know, federal agencies, the Department of Justice, the SEC, but there are smaller agencies all throughout Washington, D.C. in this area, and this can give you a good list of different options. They might not hire 100 lawyers a year. They might hire 5 or 10. There are directories of nonprofit organizations. And the other thing that I do, as I'm collecting this list, I put myself in the position of being a law student. And I'll say, for example, I want to find all the family law attorneys in a particular city. I'll go to the Bar Association directory and start to work my way backwards on it. I'll also take a look on the internet and just do a Google search because you never know. You know, bar associations are voluntary organizations, and so not everyone joins a bar association necessarily, so a Google search can be a good way to sort of figure out who else is out there. I also look at the yellow pages because I have this theory like you never know. If you want to see what the whole universe is, take a look there. The next thing that I do is I go to Martindale Hubbell, trusty Martindale Hubbell, because it gives you a way to do a lot of different searches. This is not the web-based attorney locator service. You want to avoid that. You want to go to the terms and connectors, the real old-fashioned stuff that's online. You can also get it on CD-ROM. And I did like a sample search for D.C., just to say, okay, how many, 50 or fewer firms of tax lawyers? And I got 108 hits. Not 108 job openings and not necessarily 108 results completely, because Martindale Hubbell, like any database, they're dumb, so you're going to get repeats over and over and over again. You're going to find some solo practitioners in there. But the most important fact that you should note, and this is the third bullet point, is Martindale Hubbell is not a directory of all the lawyers in the universe. It's a very expensive paid service that law firms buy into, and not every law firm is represented, not because they're not reputable and not because they're not good firms, but because it's just terribly expensive, and it's not the way – you don't get business by being in Martindale Hubbell. Trust me on this one. So keep that in mind, because a lot of times law students will come in and say – I did my search. I went on Martin Del Hubble. I did this, and I am so done. And they, you might have 30% of the market really accounted for here, so be careful. So that's like a sample of what it looks like when you get it. And what I do if I were a law student is I'd go through and say, all right, let me take a look at their website. Let me take a look at what they do. Let me take a look. And I, you can create a mail merge document by doing some research and eliminating the repeats. You can also search by law school, by college, languages, zip code. These are all really important things to do if you're interested in networking, and we're going to talk a little bit about that as well. So I gave you a sample search there, like if you want to go to New York and you want to meet people who practice tax law at smaller firms, this is one way that you can start to figure out this market. What you're trying to do here when you're doing a small firm job search is a 1-2 punch. The first punch is the research, which I was describing very quickly to you about how you go about figuring out your universe and doing that research. But the second punch in the 1-2 punch is networking. Because law, more than almost any other profession, is so relationship oriented. And small firm hiring in particular is extremely relationship oriented, I've found. In contrast, when you look at the way large law firms hire with OCI, not that they are not interested in relationships and fit, but they're looking at things from a very different angle. When they come on campus here at American, they're looking at the relative rank of American University versus other law schools where they might interview, and they're looking at you in relation to your classmates in a very strict pecking order. So it's nothing personal. They come in knowing that they're going to hit at a certain level in this class, and you can be the best person in the world, the most promising lawyer in the world. You're never going to get interviewed by them because that's the way they go through it. In contrast, and I don't want to oversimplify or make the large law firms seem like, you know, they're in any way evil or calculating. It's simply the way they tend to do business. Whereas at smaller law firms, because they hire very, very erratically, they don't come on campus. They might hire once every couple of years. It's very much relationship-based. And so getting out there in the community, and if you hate the word networking, then call it connecting. But they really need to get to know you a little bit. And I'm going to give you some ways that you can connect in because, like I said before, small firms hire when the need arises. And what they'll say when the need arises is they'll say, you know what? Sometimes a person just walks into our office or I go on for an informational interview and I have a good connect with this person. And I realize I have a job opening and I realize that summer is around the corner. It's in a few weeks and I need to make a hire. And it's like that's how it happens. They don't hire a year in advance the way large law firms do or the way large federal agencies do. So the place that I start, and I could do a whole series on networking, is start with the career services office. And if you don't go to this program tonight, you're missing out because you're going to have a panel discussion at 4:30 where people are going to speak about small firm hiring, and then there are going to be others that are going to be coming in to talk to you some more. And they're the most receptive people in the world because most of them are AU grads, so they're here for a reason. You know, it's not like you're cornering them and they're like, why is this happening? So go to that program, but connect through the career services office. Connect through your law professors. Here's an example. If you're really interested in, say, tax law, there's no reason to do this research in a vacuum and then say, oh, my God, what do I do now? Isn't it better to collect the information, see who's in the tax law section for the D.C. bar, and then go up with a list to your tax professor or an adjunct or somebody and say, listen, I'm committed to doing this kind of work, I think. I'd like some advice for you. I've collected a list of 40 mid-sized to small firms in the D.C. area that I'm really interested in. Am I missing anybody on here? And, you know, the professor can look through and say, you're missing these five firms that are really good. Are there any firms that you particularly recommend that I write to? Yeah, you know what? And they can go through and say, you know, a lot of law students worry, well, is a small firm reputable? How do I know what I'm getting into? Well, one way you can redress that issue is by saying, all right, take a look at this. Sometimes professors will say, I know so-and-so here. They're an AU graduate. I, we, you know, you should write to Jane at this place. And if you say, may I use your name when I write to Jane? And they say yes, your cover letter is going to look enormously different. Instead of saying, I am a third-year law student at American University, Washington College of Law, you know, which is like drones off, you say, Professor so-and-so recommended that I contact you because of your practice in the area of tax law. Oh, my gosh, totally different cover letter, totally different in. So ask permission, but show your work to professors or career services because they can fill in the blanks that you're necessarily going to have because it's unlikely that there's a cosmic database waiting out there for you. I'm going to talk a little bit also. Well, why this happens. I want to talk to you a little bit about sororities and fraternities. If you belong to a sorority and a fraternity in college, I highly recommend that you look at the alumni base and the alumni office and ask for leads for lawyers working in that area because a lot of times these sororities and fraternities welcome you very, very warmly into a circle, and it's really cool. And I've had law students give wonderful accounts of this. Bar associations. Bar associations can be excellent resources for you, and not just to list on your resume, okay? You know, students do this all the time. You see long listings of activities, and you know there's nothing behind it. Don't just list things. If you're going to join bar associations, join them for a specific purpose, and that is connecting with other lawyers. And here, I'm going to talk you through a little bit how to do it, but first, some lists. American Bar Association, Law Student Division, I think it's $20 to join. You can do it online. It is the best $20 you'll ever spend. And it's not because I write for Student Lawyer Magazine. When you join the ABA, which is a wonderful, wonderful organization, when you join as an attorney, it's like a car payment to do this. It's hundreds of dollars. And to do this for $20 is fabulous. So you have access to scholarship programs, internship programs, writing competitions, and all kinds of really good things. So do that. That's an easy one. They have a mentor program, so you can connect up. Also, when you go on the ABA website, you can get to a larger list of bar associations across the United States just by going to abanet.org, then go to Lawyer Resources, Professional Development, and then state and local bar associations. So if you're looking for a job, somewhere in a smaller city, smaller metro area, you can get access to the bar associations right off the bat there. There's the Bar Association of the District of Columbia, which is another bargain at $15. But here's the thing. You don't just join. You join, and then you say, strategically, how am I going to use this? Are they doing CLE classes, continuing legal education classes, in a practice area that might interest me? Well, I better show up at that CLE class so that I can mix and mingle with lawyers. Are they doing a Christmas party for the family law section, and does it behoove me to show up and introduce myself? Should I get involved with the Young Lawyers Division before I graduate and start to mix and mingle and meet lawyers that way as well? And then there are other volunteer bar associations all across. When you look at the ABA, the larger website, you'll see the range. Voluntary bar associations, there's only one bar association that you have to join, and that's the bar association that licenses you and disciplines you. So I have to belong to the Pennsylvania Bar Association, for example, because that's where I'm licensed and that's who tracks my CLE. But all my other bar association memberships are completely voluntary, and I do it for enrichment and for professional reasons. There are also what I call specialty and affinity bar associations. These are bar associations that are organized by special interest. You can find them by religion, by race. So, for example, the St. Thomas More Society for Catholic Attorneys. What a great way to meet like-situated individuals. The National Bar Association for African American Lawyers, Hispanic National Bar Association. You get the picture. You can find these. And there are specialty bar associations for everything imaginable. It's out there. And when you connect in these ways, you really have a much more concerted in because people feel a buy-in that they're going to help. When the Women's Bar Association comes and does a networking program, you have to go, ladies, because they have a vested interest in promoting and retaining women in the profession. And if you go to them and say, here's what I'd like to do, not just give me a job, that's the worst thing you can say. I know people get get to that point at some point, especially third-year students. You'll say, get me a job, any job. What you want to do is be able to have a conversation with somebody tonight. And think about this tonight when you have the networking program afterwards. Think about how you're going to introduce yourself and what your elevator speech is going to be. You know, talk about the two-minute introduction of who you are, what you're about, and what you want to do this summer, and see if you can get some connections going with the people that you meet. So how do you contact these firms? If you're doing your job, and this is a long process, this is not just going on Martin Del Hubble and going, got it, mail merge, we're done here, this is it. If you're really doing your job here and you're really exploring the job markets that you're really interested in being in, that you're committed to staying in, and where you have an interest in a practice area, you might have a couple of mail merge lists of maybe 40 tax firms or, you know, in Washington, D.C., and 15 smaller family law firms in your hometown, that sort of thing. We're talking about 100 really good letters instead of 500 sort of thrown against the wall letters, but really thinking about this carefully and segmenting the market into, well, this is my first choice of practice areas, and this is a secondary choice, and then I'm broadening it out into a third choice. So you're trying to think very calmly and very strategically about this. So how do you contact these small firms? Cover letter and a resume is all you need. Do it the old-fashioned way with a business envelope and a stamp and a typed envelope. Email is still... Unless you see a job posting through Simplicity or something else where they're like, send me the resume by email, I would say the conservative thing to do is still a cover letter and a resume sent. Don't send it unless it's a blind posting to Dear Sir or Madam, that's the kiss of death. When you get those, people know those are mass mailings. Take the time to call up or look at the website carefully and just say, to whom would I send a resume for legal employment? And if you get a receptionist whose job it is to be the gatekeeper and says, we're not hiring, kid, don't take that as a no. Like, law students, I'm always amazed. You're going to go out and be like, you know, advocates, zealous advocates for others, and students will say, well, said they're not hiring, and they put the phone down. I'm like, well, you know what, don't let the gatekeeper there just tell you no. Say, well, if I hypothetically were to send it in, who would I send it to? Or go on the website and just pick somebody who graduated, who's probably between the age of 40 and 60 in your estimation. Those people are probably, you don't want someone 2 years out of law school doing it. So make an approximation. Find the American University graduate. Find the person who went to your college. But just don't worry unduly about this. Students always want to know, well, who's the hiring person? At the small law firm, because they don't hire programmatically and all the time, a lot of times it's like Fred down the hall is the hiring person this week. You know, like they don't care. They might get a resume in and they'll say, I don't know if we're hiring. What do you say? And, you know, they all kind of talk about it. So don't just get it to a person. What should you emphasize in your cover letters and resumes? Emphasize experience and be specific about it. Avoid the Miss Americas, as I call them. You know, people always do this. You know, I'm hardworking, diligent, and a people person. Those are kind of meaningless things to say. Rather, say something like, I'm extremely hardworking. Throughout 4 years of college, I worked on a part-time basis while maintaining a 3.6 average. You know, give them, think as an advocate and not merely as, you know, like my mother would say this because, you know, she thinks the world of me. So be specific about that. Don't be afraid to talk about your desire to work in a small firm. Don't make it seem like, oh, God, well, I went through OCI, and now I know I'm not going to work at a large firm, so I guess it's you now. They can smell that a mile away. So you'd rather go in saying, you know, a small firm appeals to me because... Those are always good lead-ins. Or my desire to practice in the area of family law stems from. Those are kind of lead-in sentences that mean something. Don't just recite your resume. They have your resume. So talk to them in your cover letter about your don't be afraid to, you know, I was saying to a student today, don't be afraid to use the word passion. Like, you should be passionate about doing this. You really want to be in this city. You really want to be doing this type of practice area. So explain your presence. Dealing with grades, I always say this, and I'll say it again. Remember, at law school, you know, there are people in the class who are in the top 50%, and there are people in the bottom 50%. Well, that same that same thing happens in the real world outside, you're going to meet lawyers who unbelievably were in the bottom 50% of their class. And they're still practicing law, and they're doing really, really well, I want to assure you. So you just have to deal with grades in an intelligent way. And I think it's very hard for law students because, for the most part, we're all very, very high achievers. You probably came from college with very, very good grades, and then you get stamped with, like, the dumb stamp in law school because all of a sudden you're like, I cannot believe who has ever been in the bottom 50% of anything in your entire lives until you come to law school. And it's very damaging, I think, and I also believe very firmly that law students will close down and not even do a job search because you say, all is lost, what is the point at this point? So let's deal with grades, because small firm employers are not as obsessed about this at all as you are. And you have to kind of almost get off the grades, like the worrying about the grades thing, and move forward. And I'm going to talk about that when I fix the here. So what can you do with grades to show that you're intelligent? Number one, if you did well in law school and you didn't do so well if you did well in college and you didn't do so well in law school, don't fall into this trap that a lot of law students do, which is you take your grades off your college because you don't want to call attention to the fact that you did well in college but you didn't do well in law school. People call it like it's a parallel structure issue. They don't want it to seem like out of balance, so you take all your grades off. I think strategically this is a very bad move because when you take off your college grades and you don't list your law school grades, an employer has nothing to go on the intelligence quotient. So they're looking going, all right, I get it. Everyone gets the joke. When you don't see law school grades, we know you didn't do so well and you have some splaining to do to us, you know, later. But then when they don't see the college grades, they go, oh, is this like a really complete marginal academic person? So put those college grades on there and put them proudly because you want to give them something like, look how intelligent I was. You know, like, look what you are. You know, in college, I'm really worthy. The other things that you can do for law school are you could do selected grades. You know, sometimes, and I truly believe this, sometimes you'll just do well in some courses than others. You click with a professor, the test taking is good that day, whatever, and it's all over the board. Sometimes it's by a specific set of a cluster of courses. So do selected grades. You can do, if you're a first-year law student and the best thing you did was your open memo or your closed memo, put it on there. This is evidence. You want to give them evidence of your success. If you were lucky enough to do well in a cluster of subject areas that directly relate to a practice area that you like, which doesn't necessarily have to be the case. I'm not an advocate of, I did well in torts, I should be a personal injury lawyer. That line of logic is not particularly good. But if you did, put that on there as well. And here's the thing. You can go through a mock interview in Career Services and talk about your grades so that you have a story to tell that's logical and unemotional. You know, a lot of students will go into interviews and they'll, you know, sort of confess, you know, they'll say, I can't believe you're interviewing me, my grades are abysmal. And the small firm employer wasn't thinking about that. They saw that you went to a cool college that they like, or they know someone who went there, and that you had a great summer job experience and they want to interview you because it connects up there. And then you've like just, you know, you've put a Klieg light on the fact that you have deficient grades in some way, and now they're just focused on that. So really work on that. I always say to law students, too, that nobody in the legal profession has ever walked into somebody's office in real practice and said, listen, you have 2 hours. I'm going to read you a fact pattern. And then I'm going to close the book, and I want you to write very quickly because you need to give an answer to the client in that time period. Let's go. That's it. No one practices that way, and so the very nature of law school exams, for the most part, doesn't accurately reflect what you're supposed to be doing in practice, and you can talk about that realistically. I'm not a great test taker on these types of tests. Timing issues. You're collecting all of this information. You're writing really good cover letters and resumes. For first and second year law students, any time after January 2nd is a good time to start sending out cover letters and resumes. And if you're a 2L, one tip I can give you is it can be attractive to a small firm employer to say, you know what, I'll work on a part-time basis starting now. You need project work done, I'm available, and market yourself that way. First year's study, study, study. That's all you should be doing right now. But just because I said January 2nd doesn't mean that today, February 20th, you're like grossly behind schedule. I just don't want students sending things out to small firms in December because they're so not looking at this point. Now's a very good time to be doing research. And, you know, in a couple of weeks, you can be sending things out that are well thought out, and you're all set. And we're going to talk about what to do as follow-up. If you're a third-year student, now is also a really good time to do the research. You might have heard, like, oh, if I pass the bar exam, that's when I should really be looking. So I'm just going to turn things off until I pass the bar exam. It's kind of a mistake to do that. But what I suggest to third-year students is you have to figure out where you're taking the bar exam. You have to focus on the research right now. You have to put a lot of effort into the networking. You can offer to work on a part-time basis if that works with the locale where you're looking. And then you have to be ready to take some time off before you take the bar exam and then go right back into looking for a job once the bar exam is over. But, you know, take a long-term view of this. Don't feel like, oh, you know what, I'm going to take the bar exam, then go away for a couple of months and then see if I pass and see what happens. Because the relationship cultivation is so important, you should be doing that now, absolutely now. So what do? You send out good cover letters and resumes. Don't mail and run. It is okay. You don't have to do this. I just offer this as a suggestion to law students who like to do this. You can phone or email. I think email is kind of preferable. 5 to 7 business days afterwards to reiterate your interest. It's okay. If you're a first-year law student sending these out, it's okay to say, hi, this is Donna Gerson. I sent a cover letter and resume last week to you for about a summer job. I know you're really busy, but I want to reiterate my strong interest in a position at your firm. Spring break is coming up, and this is a great time for you to be going out and interviewing, whether in your hometowns or here, to meet with lawyers. So you can, you know, market yourself that way. And don't feel that if you're not rejected, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't write again. And I say this because, you know, you might get a couple of responses. One is the total abyss of no response at all, which is, it happens. I mean, it's not, you know, that's what happens with small firms. Sometimes it just sits on their desks, I see. Sometimes it gets thrown out. Okay, don't take it personally. Law students tend to take stuff terribly personally, and it's not a good thing. They get very wounded, and then they don't want to write to firms anymore, and they have to, like, recover from this. Write again. If you get a letter back that says, we're not hiring at this time, okay, then in 3 months, 4 months, write again. If they say, we do not hire unless you're licensed to practice law in Maryland, okay, thanks for the tip. When I pass the Maryland bar, it's going in a file, and you're going to get a letter from me telling me that I passed I'm going to tell you that I passed the Maryland bar, and maybe we should start talking. Unless you get a letter to me that says, we will never hire you ever under any circumstances, and, you know, your name is going down in our, you know, database or something, I say a cyclical writing is okay, because what small firms will say is, we hire when the need arises. And sometimes we're very busy and we're preoccupied and we have other things going on in our life that is not personal to you or anything you've done. But in 3 or 4 months, we're receptive to the idea that we might need to hire you. And students are always surprised about this. You don't have to reference, I wrote to you 3 months ago and I'm writing to you again. It sounds like you're stalking them. I would just write to them again because anecdotally, I can tell you that, first of all, small firms don't care. They'll get a letter. They'll get another letter in a couple of months. Students have said to me, you wouldn't believe it, but I wrote, you know, 3 times to this firm, and on the 4th letter that was like, where have you been all these years? You have exactly the credentials we're looking for. And it's all a matter of sort of timing, cultivation of your connections, and serendipity in some ways. Interview tips. When you get an interview with a small firm, they are not interviewing for their health. I can tell you this. It's not like when large firms come on campus and they have to interview like 21 people and they have marching orders to bring back 6 for a callback interview and then they call the herd further and all of that. When you get a call from a small firm, they're saying, I'm genuinely interested in you because we might only be interviewing you. Or we might be interviewing 3 or 4 people, but when the right person comes along, we're going to make the hire. So, tips. be prompt about scheduling a time. This is not the time to be like coy with them. I'm very busy. I'm entertaining other offers at this time. Drop everything, go to the interview, because a lot of times the person who's first in has a strategic advantage over other candidates. Research the firm, know the lawyers, okay? You're going to get one, you know, remember this, you only need one job offer to get one job. There's no inherent virtue in collecting offers. You're not going to regale your grandchildren with stories about how many offers you had at one point. All you need is a job. So research the firm and know the lawyers, because you want to go in and be like, okay, family law firm. You have your story right, because you don't want to blow it on the fact that you think they're a PI firm and they're actually a family law firm. Anticipate the objections that you might have by thinking ahead. And when I think about this, is law students come in with a big list of things that they feel are like the scarlet letter. You know, I have terrible grades. There's a gap in my resume. I never even know what this means anymore. Students feel like if there's a gap, you know, people will discover the gap on their resume. Lawyers are not tuned into this very much at all. They know you're a student. You're going to work a little, then you're going to go study abroad. They don't care about gaps so much. You might not have gotten an offer from your firm the summer before. It is not a terrible issue, but it's an issue that needs to be discussed. So some of the objections that law students have are real, and they need to be addressed. And some of them are completely imagined and are messing you up in the interviews, because you're thinking, you know, when you're only thinking about one thing, it's what you're going to talk about, and you don't want to go there. So rehearse. Schedule a mock interview. I think the only time I actually met a law student who had a bona fide issue that I was like, wow, that is a deal breaker, was they got into law school by not disclosing that they had a prior arrest and conviction. Arrest is one thing. Conviction is another. And, you know, we discovered that, you know, he had a conviction and that he couldn't sit for the Pennsylvania bar. I mean, it was a serious, serious issue. It was one case, and I've been doing this since like 2000, for a long time, since 1993. So a lot of things that law students imagine are not actually like issues, or they might be small issues that are surmountable by being a good advocate. So rehearse, go to Career Services. They'll do one-on-one mock interviews. And also, if you see that they're offering a program where they bring in lawyers from outside to do mock interviews, those are great. You should do those, because it's completely objective and wonderful. And write a thank you letter promptly. I prefer a typed business correspondence, but email can be okay if generationally the people you're dealing with, the law firm you're dealing with, is e-friendly. Otherwise, I say go traditional, go old school, write a thank you letter. I want to conclude with just a few remarks. Small firms can be great, great places to work. It's not for everybody. So I'm not coming, I don't go to law school saying everyone should work at a small firm. Statistically, most people in private practice will be at these small firms, but go in with your eyes open about what these work environments are like, the pressure that you're going to be under, the salaries you're going to get. You might decide that you want to go to a small firm, but you want to clerk for a judge first and get some experience under your belt. You might want to go to a government agency first. You don't know. But these are wonderful places to work. Everyone will find a job who wants to find a job, but you're going to have to work really hard at this. This is not just answering posted ads on Simplicity or in a law journal. You're really going to have to work a lot of resources to do this and to do this well. You got to get out there in the legal community. Instead of network, 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 let's just say connect, connect, connect. You've got to. Law students, generationally, we spend a lot of time behind screens now, and we interact with the world with screens a lot because, you know, I write about this sometimes, about MySpace and, Facebook and all these other places where generationally, law students now are interacting a lot more with experiencing the world through their screens. And so it's very easy, I think, to fall into the trap of saying, I'm just going to stay in this safe place and not go out and shake hands and talk to people and do informational interviews. And I really urge you to sort of use the screen. It's great. I love my computer, but also get out there as well and partner with Career Services. They have the expertise and they have the connection, but the other gift that they have, which I really, you know, can't express enough, is they give you objectivity. That's the thing that I found when I worked at the University of Pittsburgh. when you come to law school, you come with a lot of baggage. You come with expectations from your family. You come with expectations from spouses or boyfriends or girlfriends or partners. And everyone's imprinting their, like, ideal version of you on you. And it's very hard sometimes because you have things that you want to do and you're getting some pushback from other sources. But the gift of going into career services is it's completely, utterly objective. All they want to do is look at your resume as a strange, as an objective person saying, here's what I'm seeing about you that you might not even see in yourself. So work with the Career Services Office because they can offer you the resources to make this all happen. And now you have to get to work and go do the research. So I wish you luck, and I'm happy to answer questions if there's time permitting. So thank you. I've never had a screen blackout like this before, so five times I had to do this. So sorry. Any questions? No questions? Oh, I could come back and talk about that, or I can talk to you about, like, the path. Yeah, absolutely. There's so many lawyers out there who are very happy. We're licensed. We're doing really, I think, cool, fun things, and not, you know, doing timesheets. Yeah, come up and talk. Okay. You mean a follow-up cover letter, like you're writing a second time to a firm? Yeah, I wouldn't even refer, unless they said, please write to us in 3 months. You know, but if they're giving you a general, like, we're not hiring at this time, then that's fine. You don't have to write back and say, you know, by letter of, you know, February, you know, 20th, yeah. Yeah. Oh, one more?
Yeah,
huge range. I think it was in the PowerPoint. Yeah, it's a huge range, and it gets lower in rural areas and higher in urban areas. But you really consult Career Services because they have a better handle on sort of the local trends that are happening. Sure.
During an interview, I got thrown for a loop. I was told that I was given an offer, and I was told I have to speak to the office manager to negotiate my salary.
Uh huh.
And it's a firm that doesn't propose what their first-year associates make.
Uh-huh.
And it's in a big city, in Miami. So I have no idea how to confront the office manager, who's not a lawyer. And
are you a third year?
No, I'm a second year.
Okay.
For a summer associate position.
Okay. What I would do, first of all, I'd talk to Career Services. I would look at what some Miami law firms are paying in the NALP directory just to get a figure for it. I would also, and this is advice I would give to third-year law students when it comes to salaries, you kind of have to, you know, the numbers look scary, but what you have to do as a third-year is sort of back this out in a reverse way and say, what are my student loan payments going to be? What are my housing costs going to be? What is my car rent? And you have to figure out what your monthly budget is, and then break it down and figure it out because then you want to add several thousand dollars to that as your, you know. But the problem is students will, like, sort of say, they'll pull a number out of a hat and they won't have it. And I think it gives you a lot more credibility when you're negotiating on salary to say, look, I'm going to put my cards on the table here. Here's what my student loans are, and here's what my housing is. And when I tally it up, this is where I am, and this is what I need to get paid. That's for third years. I would talk to Career Services and just see what the Miami firms are doing and then figure it out on, usually summer associates now get paid on a weekly basis, so to figure it out on a weekly basis. Oh, yeah. The question for, like, looking remotely West Coast. First of all, your first line of defense is reciprocity at a law school in the locale where you're looking. So if you're looking in San Diego, find the San Diego law school that, you know, Cooley is out there. And I would work through the Career Services Office, so you have the right to visit out there and see, because the local law schools have a much better handle just by their locale on those local postings and things like that. So I would do that. I would use your spring break very, very wisely. So if you're going home or going to be around for spring break or any other time, I highly recommend that law students, you don't have to like spend your whole spring break looking for a job, but I would devote one day and be very focused and say, today is connecting day, networking day. And you can do this now pending March break and say, when I go home, I'm going to spend 9 to 5 on Wednesday going on informational interviews, going to the Bar Association headquarters in San Diego or wherever you might be going to meet with the executive director and introduce myself. And then I'm going to have coffee with an American university grad who's practicing law down there. And then I'm going to find someone who went to my college and really stack up a load of appointments and that and get in that way. That's those are the suggestions I would have to get started. And you can do that remotely from here. That's a valid concern to have. I mean, small firms might be saying, you know, you're welcome to work here on a part-time basis while you study for the bar, but we're not going to make a decision until you've passed the bar and are admitted because, you know, small firms will say, you have kind of limited utility to us as a law clerk. Frankly, some of the paralegals are, you know, extremely well-trained paraprofessionals, and they're able to do a lot of things that you don't even know how to do yet, so why am I hiring you when I have a paraprofessional on staff? But it shouldn't stop you as a third year from doing a lot of exploration right now, and you might be getting that from firms saying, we're not hiring now, we will hire when you pass the bar, and that's a good operative fact to have, because then you save those letters, they're ready to go and when you pass the bar, but in the meantime, you should continue looking, because some of them will want to have arrangements like, they'll say, you know what, work for us on a project basis, work for us on you know, this issue for us, we'd like to get to know you, and that will help you, and it's very unscientific, I think. And I think that bothers law students because they're like, look, I just want to send a letter in. I want to get an interview. I want to close the deal. I want to wear my mortarboard, and that's it. And it's going to, I think it's going to be a little more circuitous as you go through. You had a question? Well, I can't speak for all small. Oh, you mean when you graduate in May? Yeah, I mean, I don't want to speak for all small law firms that they all want to do this, but from a business perspective, first of all, a lot of them are very busy and they don't know what to do with some overflow work. And so if there's an issue, like they want to research a topic and they simply don't have time because they're doing something that's much more pressing, it's attractive to them to have a third year student with experience who's taking the bar exam do some project work for them. In fact, when if someone says, I'm very busy, I don't have time to talk to you, you know, it can always be a nice like entree for you to say, and if you're busy, I'm the perfect solution because I can work on a project basis and alleviate some of that tension in your life because I'll do the work for you. But they will hire on a part-time basis because, you know what, it's not a lot of risk for them. You know, they'll pay you an hourly wage. You don't get benefits, but you get the benefit of putting it on your resume. They get to know you, and hopefully they will, you know, also, you know, talk you up in their community of lawyers so that they're like, you know what, we have this great kid who's working here. We can't hire him on a full-time basis. We're not set up for that. But you know what? Do you want to interview him? He might be a good match for your firm. And so you get in, at least you're circulating. The worst thing that law students do is they'll say, my grades stink, and I have to focus on passing the bar, so I'm just taking myself completely out of circulation until November. imagine all that time that you've wasted not sort of being out there in the community, not going to, you know, not going to events. Not that you should be like a social butterfly, but there should be a good balance of, I got to get out there and talk to people. I got to meet the AU grads. I got to meet college grads. And people have to know what I'm looking for. So. Yeah. I prefer email, and what I would a short note to say, you know, dear so and so, like write it like a business correspondence. I would say, dear so and so, last week I sent a resume and cover letter regarding a summer position with your firm. I realize how busy you are, but I wanted to reiterate my strong interest in working for your firm this summer. Give a quick recap of, you know, my interest in working at your firm stems from, you know, or I'm deeply interested in X because of, and then say, I am, you know, I would be delighted to interview with your firm or to meet you on an informal basis. I'm available all throughout spring break, March, whatever, whatever, and take it from there, you know, sincerely, and that's it. And I think this way, too, I mean, I say to law students, you don't have to do this, because some students are like, oh, my God, it's another thing to do. I think it alleviates some of the tension that law students have, which is they get really, you know, you don't get a lot of closure. I hate to use that word closure because it's not even, but students will say, I send out these resumes, and then there's nothing. No one talks to me. And I feel awful, and I feel bad, and now I'm not going to do anything with my job search. And this way I'm like, all right, here's something that you can do. And law firm employers have said they do not react badly to this because they'll say, look, I'm busy all day long doing billable work, and I'm frantic. I got to get all this stuff done. And this is just, you know, the cover letter and resume, while very nice, is not on my urgent to-do list right now. It doesn't have to be because other stuff is there. But if I get a pleasant email that's non-threatening or a pleasant voicemail message that doesn't sound like you're you know, like a lunatic, that says, I want to reiterate my interest and you have a nice voice. I've had lawyers have said, you know what, the kid sounded earnest. The kid actually made an effort to call me. The law student actually might have not done this as a mass mailing. I might want to talk to them. And so it increases the opportunity that you've taken that small extra step, and you'd be amazed at how few steps law students are actually willing to take. So when you take even that small extra step, you distinguish yourself from the pack of law students that are out there. It's amazing. I go to law schools all the time. I hand out my business card to them, and I'll say, please keep in touch with me. I was just out I was at a number of New York law schools 2 weeks ago, and I probably met a total of 50 law students at three law schools. One law student wrote to say, thank you for meeting with me. And it was really interesting. And they all seemed genuinely nice and appreciative and everything, but one law student, a woman, took the time to write a short note to say, you know what, you took the time to talk to me, and I really appreciated that you looked at my resume, and thanks. And I wrote back and said, you win. You're the only one of about 50 law students. I said, this bodes well for your future. You're going to find a job. So I'm happy to hang out, so thanks.